Blog Talk Radio.
This is Surreal Quinn, and the Saturday morning wake-up call is coming up right now.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this latest edition of the Saturday morning wake-up call on this 2nd of April 2011, as I take you for the next 90 minutes, as we will discuss the world of sports, a big weekend of sports, Final Four weekend, as the road ends in Houston, Reliant Stadium. Around 77,000 people will be in attendance to watch four unlikely teams take the court tonight in the Final Four, with Butler, VCU kicking it off, and of course the nightcap with the two powerhouses, UConn and Kentucky. Chat line is up for my friends on Blog Talk Radio, so definitely you can hit me up with any questions, comments that you may have over the course of the show. I'll do my best to get to as many as possible. Call number is, as always, 347-215-6180, 347-215-6180. We're going to have Mark Malusis on at around 12 o'clock, a little bit after that, talk some Yankee Met baseball, some Final Four as well, so stay tuned for that spot. But, of course, we begin with the Final Four, and just one of the most craziest and unpredictable tournaments, you know, of all time, I believe. This Final Four, none of these teams at the beginning of the season were expected to be here. Forget about VCU. I mean, they were not even, I don't think people expected them to even be in the tournament. But, you know, Butler losing Gordon Hayward, Kentucky too young. You know, they're good. They'll make the tournament, but you know, there won't be anything more than a first round Sweet 16 type team. Next year, 2012 will be their year. And UConn picked 10th in the Big East in the preseason by the so-called experts. And then they go out, you know, set the tone with that Maui Invitational win, destroy Kentucky in that final. And from there on, you know, you knew that you were going to have to hear from the UConn Huskies. So none of these teams were expected to be here. The highest seeding ever in a Final Four history in terms of average seed, which is closest, is 6.5. You know, is ridiculous. We've never had two number 11 seeds. No number is the first time ever that we haven't had at least one number one or number two seed. That's never happened before. We've had years where there have been no number ones, but never has there been any of the top eight seeds left in this tournament. Connecticut is number three seed. The highest seed team left in the tournament at number three. And again, it is, you know, when you look at these matchups. Well, first of all, I want to dispel this whole idea that, you know, once we get to the Final Four, that it needs to be reseeded. That is the dumbest thing, and I've heard people say it. I hear people say it all the time to try to set up the best matchups, and you know people want UConn and Kentucky in a national championship. First of all, from a story standpoint, you want either Butler or VCU in a national championship. Okay. I mean, the way the matchups are set up, it guarantees that you're going to have a David versus Goliath type, you know, matchup. Now, all four of these teams are very closely matched. Let's be honest. I mean, some, you know, Kentucky, I would say Kentucky and UConn probably have to have the most NBA talent. But as teams, these are four evenly matched teams. Any one of these teams can walk on with the national championship on Monday night easily. But, you know, you're going to walk home. I mean, on Monday night, you're going to get a mid-major versus a big-time blue blood type school. You're guaranteed for that. So I don't know how, like, I don't know what's, I mean, this is what the term is all about. It's about the little guy. It's about the upsets. It's about, you know, that, you know, can the mid-major stand up to the big-time schools? Can they beat VCU or Butler win a national championship? You're not getting that if you have UConn and Kentucky playing for a national championship. And who is to say that UConn, that a Butler or VCU doesn't deserve to be in a championship or playing for the national championship any more than UConn and Kentucky? Because the last time I checked, they both, Butler and VCU, had to win four games to get here. VCU had to win five games. So let's not try to manipulate the system to try to create a matchup, to try to create a matchup that is perceived that we want to see, that everybody thinks that everybody wants to see. I'm perfectly fine with the matchups as is. Perfectly fine. Have no problem whatsoever. Only thing that's missing is my North Carolina Tar Heels. That's the only thing that's missing. Why did I bring that up? That's the first time I thought about it all week, that North Carolina was not in the Final Four and they got eliminated in the Elite Eight. First time I thought about it all week. All right, moment of silence for the Tar Heels. That was it. That's it. I'm done with it. I'm over with it. It's over now. Tar Heels are not going to be in the Final Four and not going to win a championship. Okay. I have no problem with Butler and VCU. Kentucky, UConn is going to be a great matchup. We all know this. It's the marquee game. You already manipulate the matchup, not the matchups, but, you know, the second game being the marquee game. That's as close as the NCAA should come to, you know, having the primetime matchup, having any say in, you know, what and who plays. And that's always been the case. The better game is always played second. And I have zero problem with that. That's television from a rating standpoint. That's what you want. As far as, you know, who I like, and that is the poll question of the day, the Saturday morning wake-up call poll question, who will play for the national championship Monday night? Again, any one of these teams can win the championship. That's what makes this Final Four so great, that any one of these teams can walk away as on Monday night with the trophy. But tonight, I'm looking at Butler and UConn, and I'm going to tell you why. UConn, to me, has the best of both worlds. They have two major things going for them. Number one, they have the best player remaining in the tournament, by far. By far. Okay? He played, you know, Kemba Walker played in the Final Four 2 years ago when UConn got picked off by Michigan State. The guy is playing, and I heard John Calipari give a very favorable comparison and make a very to in terms of Kemba Walker to Danny Manning, and that's a perfect comparison because it is very much similar to what Danny Manning did, of course, in 1988 when Kansas made this unlikely run to the national championship, even when they were called Danny and the Miracles. The second thing they have going for them is, as great as Brad Stevens has been, two Final Fours with Butler, Shaka Smart, one of the, you know, hot names in coaching right now, will certainly get a top job, whatever job he wants, basically, in the next couple of years. And Calipari, who, of course, is the best coach to never win a championship right now, active. None of them have championships. And UConn has the one guy who four Final Fours and two national championships. That resume, you combine all the resumes of the opponent of the other three teams, it doesn't add up to one Jim Calhoun's resume. That is an enormous advantage on the college level at this stage when you're talking about a single game elimination type tournament. Enormous advantage to have a studying influence, to have a guy who's been there before, who knows what it takes to win a national championship. So I like UConn to get to the final. I don't think Kentucky will, you know, be able to make as many threes as they made against North Carolina. UConn is a much better defensive team than North Carolina. And the bottom line is UConn has had a full week to prepare, as, you know, in comparison to North Carolina only having, you know, basically a, you know, what, 24 hours or 36 hours to get ready for the game last weekend. Second game is tougher to pick. VCU, every time you want to go against VCU, they make you look stupid. They have become, you know, They have become the team that everybody loves. They become certainly the, you know, they've kind of taken Butler's place as a team that everybody is rooting for to win this whole thing. I think that Butler, the thing I like, the reason why I like Butler is I love their experience. Again, something that you cannot discount. You cannot discount the Final Four experience from last year. I can see VCU, despite all the things that Shaka Smart might be saying, I can see them in a mode of they're just happy to be here. And that's the mode that a lot of sports teams face when they get to a championship situation unexpectedly for the first time. We see teams face it in the Super Bowl. We see teams face it in the Final Four. It's human nature. Somebody doesn't expect you to get somewhere, and you get there, and you're happy to be there. VCU wasn't expecting to be in the Final Four at the beginning of the year. Let's be realistic. Now they're coming out saying all the right things, but they didn't think they were going to be playing for a national championship. So, and to me, one of the things that has not been talked about enough as far as Butler is, Butler played for the championship last year. How about the idea that Butler is on a mission to, you know, to finish the job? I mean, we screamed about North Carolina in 2009, you know, one coming back from that embarrassing Final Four loss to Kansas in 2008 about, hey, wanting to finish the job, complete the mission. Well, we did that because it's North Carolina. But nobody talks about that from a Butler perspective. Did anybody think about that? Butler was still steaming from that loss against Duke and that they thought they should have beat Duke last year, despite the fact that it was a close game throughout. So I don't think that that's not motivation for Butler. And you love, again, Butler will have the best player on the court in Shelvin Mack. And the experience, I give the advantage to that. And, again, having a week to prepare for that to stop that three-point shooting of VCU, which has been just – off the charts. I mean, 44% from three-point range is ridiculous. And again, they are due. VCU is due for one of those 9-for-25, 6-for-26 nights from three-point range. They're due to have one of these bad three-point shooting nights. But again, both games will be very close, highly competitive, and wouldn't be surprised to see any combination as far as who's playing for the national championship on Monday night. Just getting started here on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, a special 90-minute edition of the Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Surreal Quinn. When we return, we'll talk about have Saturday morning headlines and react quotes as well, and open up our baseball segment as the 2011 baseball season got started on Thursday afternoon. So we'll talk some baseball when we return on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call.
When you walk through the garden, gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk the straight and narrow.
Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, 2nd of April 2011. Can't believe it's already April. Year is flying by as we head towards hopefully spring sometime soon. I mean, this weather has been driving me crazy. Well, you still have to pull out basically winter coats to go to work every day, but spring will be here soon. I'm confident that spring is on its way, just not right now, unfortunately. Surreal Quinn, again, taking you for 90 minutes 90 minutes on this special Final Four edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. We will be doing a Monday Cyril Quinn review show leading up to Monday night's national championship game. So stay tuned for times in terms of that show. I would say, as of right now, probably be around 27:30 and 8. Might do an hour and a half, maybe. It depends. It depends on how I feel. I'll let you know, though. I will let you know. Saturday morning headlines. Cardinals slugger Matt Holliday has an appendectomy, had his appendix removed. He will be out from anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. In the grand scheme of things, in the short term, it hurts. Long term, not a big deal. The baseball season, of course, as we all know, is an absolute marathon. But it just adds to what has been a tumultuous offseason for the St. Louis Cardinals. And really going back to the latter part of last season when, you know, they were battling tooth and nail with the Cincinnati Reds for that NL Central title, and they kind of fell apart. And the Reds ended up winning the division, and Cardinals didn't make the playoffs. Has not been a good 6 or 7 months for the Cardinals, the whole Albert Pujols situation. Adam Wainwright, you know, their ace pitcher, out for the season. Listen, and trust me, I know this as a New York Mets fan. Your season can come apart quickly. It does not take a lot for your season to just completely fall apart. And there's nothing worse as a sports fan than having a bad baseball team to root for. You have to root for, because unlike the NFL, 16 games, 4 or 5 months, or the NBA, which is a marathon, baseball is 6 months, 162 games. That is a long time to be watching mediocrity. It's a long time. So, you know, I don't know what kind of year the Cardinals are going to have. I'm not in love with the Cardinals. Me personally, I like Cincinnati and Milwaukee in that division, but things are not looking good. There's some bad karma with the Cardinals right now. You know, who knows if La Russa finishes out the year, or, I mean, if he comes back next year, he'll finish out the year. But not a good sign. That is something, I mean, to happen on the second day of the regular season is just, it's not a good sign if you're a Cardinals fan. ESPN analyst Jalen Rose has been pulled from the air due to a DUI charge that occurred in early March. And you know, from what ESPN is saying, it wasn't the charge that got him pulled off the air. It's the fact that it was the cover-up and the fact that he waited to, didn't tell ESPN right away. Again, you've heard it a million times. The cover-up is always worse than the deed, more times than not. And Rose chose not to tell ESPN that he was pulled over with a DUI charge. I guess he feared that he might be fired. To me, if you're Jalen Rose, you've had no prior incidents in the past since you've gotten on ESPN. I think you would have to take your chances and just say, look, and just come out right up front and say, hey, this is what happened. I made a mistake, and so on. You know, maybe he gets put on an administrative leave. But I think this is it. I mean, I think ESPN is going to pull him for good. He's been pulled from the air. He hasn't been fired or suspended. I don't know what, like, to me, if he's been pulled from the air, he's suspended. If he's not on the air, he's suspended. Now you can sit up here and tell me that he's not fired. That's fine. Okay, he's not fired, but he's just not going to be in the air. But don't tell me that he's not fired, one, and number two, that he's not suspended. Then what is he? What is he doing? What are you doing with him? He's got to either be fired or suspended. It's either or. He's either working, fired, or suspended. So, I mean, ESPN, again, I'm kind of confused by that ordeal as far as where his status is at. It's not looking good. I mean, you know, when things like that happen, you know, of that magnitude, a guy normally doesn't turn out well. Again, I think Rose is very good at what he does, by the way. I think he's excellent. But it's unfortunate, especially coming off that, you know, Fab Five documentary and we've heard the controversy that has come off that with Krzyzewski and Grant Hill and the whole nine yards. So hopefully ESPN gives him another chance to get his stuff together and he gets back on the air. But again, it is not looking good. A couple of Giant fans were attacked by two Dodger fans following Thursday's action when the Giants lost to the Dodgers 2-1. One guy was beaten so bad that he is in critical condition in the hospital. So a couple of Giant fans are leaving the parking lot, and they get followed by two Dodger fans, and then also the Dodger fans, go and basically try to beat the hell out of this guy for just no apparent reason, just because he's a Giant fan. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that just it kind of deters you from going to the ballpark. And again, it makes absolutely zero sense. Forget about that. Forget about the fact that the Dodgers actually won the game. I mean, forget about that. That's inconsequential. I just mentioned that because they did win the game. But the guy is in a stable but serious condition. So hopefully he's fine. That happened out in L.A. late Thursday evening following the Giants-Dodgers game that kicked off the season. So there you go with Saturday morning headlines on this Saturday morning headlines on the Saturday morning wake-up call. Still to come, we will get into some baseball, some late-night baseball, a couple of teams, a couple of star pitchers get rocked, and the Texas Rangers picked up where they left off. We'll talk about that, and also the salaries in baseball. Wait till you find out how much baseball player, how much these teams, how many $100 million teams there are in baseball. You might be surprised. This is the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call, Cyril Quinn. Call number is 347-215-6180, 347-215-6180. We'll be right back. After 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, Cyril Quinn. As we open the baseball season, which kicked off Thursday, and before we get into last night's action and some of the other things I want to talk about in regards to the baseball, I don't like this whole idea of having the opening day, number one, on a Thursday. You can't sit up here, if you're ESPN or if you're Major League Baseball, and try to sell me on 2 days of opening day. I'm sorry. I mean, I understand they had some good games, and having Dodgers, Giants, Yankees, Tigers, Red Sox, Rangers. I understand that. Philly, with Philadelphia as well. But opening day, it's called opening day, not opening days. And to me, having opening day on the same day as when the national championship ends is perfect. It's a perfect segue closing one season and beginning another. So open, I mean, again, you cannot sell me on the fact that, you know, opening day is made for one day. And having only 12 teams play on opening day is a joke. You got six games on opening day. Six. You have to have at least, I would think, 13 to 14 games. If you want to have, you know, a couple of teams, you know, two to four teams sit out for opening day, that's fine. But the majority of your teams should be playing on opening day. Bottom line. So I don't like, you know, I was not feeling it at all. Number one, and number two, it kind of takes away a little bit from the Final Four. You know, the Final Four will be the number one focus this weekend in the sports world. But when you start the season on a Thursday, now you're headed into your first full weekend of baseball. So the baseball does, you know, baseball is a popular sport right now. Revenues have gone through the roof. So the interest level has definitely picked up. So I just, you know, that's one thing baseball needs to look into. NFL can get away with it because the NFL is a kickoff weekend. It's not, you know, it's a different concept. It's kickoff weekend. You can have a game on Thursday. You can have your Thursday night game that kicks off the season. You can have your Sunday night game and then your Monday night doubleheader that, you know, NBC and ESPN does. So, and that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect for the opening of a season. It should be a celebration when the NFL season opens. And baseball could be a celebration, you know, when the season opens. There's no problem with that. But it's one day and one day only. As far as last night's action, Dodgers defeat the Giants 4-3. Good start for the Dodgers, beating the Giants twice to start off the season. Again, I know it's only the first two games of the season, but again, you want to set that tone early if you're the Dodgers. Dodgers are making me look good because they were one of my surprise teams. I thought they would be better than people expected. We'll see how long it lasts. But again, they've won the first two games by both one run as they kick off the season. Texas outlasts Boston 9-5. A couple late home runs. David Murphy hits a home run. They knocked around John Lester. A couple of big time pitchers got knocked around yesterday. Yobardo Jimenez got knocked around for Colorado as Arizona defeated them 7-6. A wild game in Chicago, 15-10. Big day for Adam Dunn, coupled with four RBIs and a home run. One pitcher that, you know, picked up where he left off. Felix Hernandez, complete game. Seattle defeat, knocking around Oakland 6-2 as they won. Toronto, you know, destroying Minnesota 13-3. Jose Bautista again picking up where he left off. Has a home run in their opening game. So, you know, baseball season is up and running. You'll have a couple of series resume that started on Thursday. Yankees Tigers is one of them, so you can keep your eyes on that. Of course, we already talked about the Dodgers Giants series that's gotten started. Good win for Baltimore last night, 4-1. They beat David Price. Listen, I like this Baltimore team. I think Buck Showalter brings an attitude. I love what he said. I talked about it on the program last week. Love what he said about the Yankees and Red Sox and taking shots at them and Jeter and the whole bit with that. So I'm expecting some big things out of Baltimore as far as being respectable. I would not be surprised, even in that division, if Baltimore comes close to finishing at 500. So keep your eyes on the Orioles this year. I myself will try to pay closer attention to them during the course of the year. USA Today comes out with the salaries of the teams and individual players earlier this week. Yesterday or Thursday. Very interesting. And again, I'm not going to get into the individual players' salaries. We know A-Rod and Jeter and those guys make a ton of money. to share and what have you. But you look at the top payrolls with the Yankees, Phillies, Red Sox, Angels, and White Sox are your top five. And the interesting thing about it is, you know, baseball tries to sell themselves on the fact that they don't have to, that you don't have to have a big time payroll to, you know, to compete or to win. I kind of disagree with that because I'm looking at these teams. I'm looking at the eight teams who made the playoffs last year, and I'm looking at their current payrolls. Only Tampa Bay, and Cincinnati have payrolls under $85 million out of last year's playoff teams. Yankees, $202 million. Philadelphia, $172 million. Minnesota, over $100 million. Atlanta is in the 80s, between $85 and $90 million. Tampa Bay this year will have a $41 million payroll. I want to see how they do with that particular payroll. Cincinnati last year was $71. This year it will be $75. Again, you know, we'll see how long they'll be able to compete with that payroll. My point is, you still have to have money and have to have a relatively healthy payroll in order to compete and win championships. You might get away one year with having a $50 or $60 million payroll for one year, but over a sustained period of time, it's not going to fly. This is not. I mean, you're not going to be able to compete with the Bostons, the New Yorks of the world with those type of, with that kind of payroll. The AL Central has three teams with $100 million payrolls, Minnesota, Detroit, and the White Sox. How does Kansas City have a chance in that division with that with those three teams with the $100 million payrolls? They don't. They have no chance. 12 teams in Major League Baseball have payrolls over $100 million. 12. Again, times are good in baseball as far as revenue. I mean, that's one thing. But that's one thing, you know, Bud Selig can hang his hat on. All these revenues and, you know, attendance figures are great. People are going out to the ballparks. Prices are reasonable. And you know, listen, you go to Yankee Stadium, you're going to pay a ton of money. I mean, that's just all there is to it. You go to Fenway Park, you're going to pay a ton of money. I mean, it's Boston and New York. It's like if you were going to go to a Laker game. But for the most part, the baseball ticket is reasonable. You can go to a couple of baseball games over the course of the season. A couple of key injuries to start off the season, really almost a who's who as far as pitchers goes. I mean, Jake Peavy. You have Zach Greinke. Cincinnati has a couple of guys out, Johnny Cueto and Homer Bailey. Brian Wilson, you know, from the Giants with the oblique muscle. So, you know, now would be the time to get to all these injuries out the way. A guy starting out the season on the DL is not that big a deal. But, you know, around May, June, you want to see some of these guys start to come back if you have these particular teams. Johan Santana with the Mets, he could be out till July. We'll talk to Belusis about that and see how long he's out. So, you know, you guys, I always believed, I always said this, and I always thought this for a long time, that you can never, ever in baseball have enough starting pitching. Never. I mean, guys are going to get hurt. Guys are going to go on a DL. You know, even the most durable guys might miss a start here and there. Never have enough starting pitching. 34 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. When we return, we'll get to React Quotes, and we'll also get into the NBA as things have tightened up for the race for number one. We'll talk about that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Thank you. Welcome back to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Cyril Quinn. Call number is 347-215-6180 as we discuss the world of sports. React quotes is coming up. Just two quotes today. Two quotes, because one of them I want to spend a little bit more time than I normally do with React quotes. But I'll get to the first one here. The sooner, the better. That is NCAA President Mark Emmert referring to the thought that it might be time for athletes to get a little bit more out of, you know, in terms of the money situation with the NCAA. Now, he does not want to, let me get this clear, he does not want to directly pay athletes. What he wants to do is increase the worth of their scholarships and include, so it can include, you know, so maybe a guy, maybe, you know, if you have a son or daughter playing college athletics, maybe they can do, when they go to do laundry, they can wash their whites along with the colors. Or maybe when they go to a movie theater, they can buy some popcorn instead of, you know, sneaking, instead of going by CVS and sneaking some Milk Duds and a Sprite in their pocket. So that's what he wants to do. Or maybe he can make a maybe your son or daughter can make an extra visit home at one extra visit home when they get an opportunity to. Listen, these kids, like, you know, he goes in this article, USA Today article, and, you know, again, he wants to up the value of the scholarships. And he does not want to get, let me make this clear, he does not want to directly pay the players. He wants to up the value of the scholarships. He claims in this article that each scholarship is worth at about $120,000, which you say to yourself, wow, $120,000 is a lot of money. Yeah, it's a lot of money, but when the Final Four is generating $771 million a year, or when you have a situation where, you know, the college basketball just signed a $11 billion deal with TBS for the TBS's broadcast rights, for the broadcast rights of the tournament, $120,000 is not a lot. It's nothing. So again, it's that, you know, we get into the age old argument to pay or not to pay. I mean, if you have listened to this program long enough, you know where I stand on this. I think it's the biggest hypocrisy in the world of sports today, why athletes don't get compensated, in particular in basketball and football. And to me, you know, this situation there, again, I'm very interested to see where this goes. You know, how much are they going to up the scholarships? What extra benefits are they going to give these guys, athletes, as far as their scholarships are concerned? To me, this is something that should have been included in the scholarship, as far as typical college expenses. How typical college expenses are not covered in the scholarship are beyond me. You know, it's the reason why you see guys, you know, from Auburn taking expensive handshakes, $100, you know, where you have boosters giving them $50s and $100 when they shake their hands. So again, we're gonna see where they go with this. I know Roy Williams comes out and says that they should add, that scholarships, you know, should measure up to, you know, to this UNC Morehead Cain Scholarship Award that covers travel and computers and things. No, but listen, that stuff, I mean, no student wants to hear about that. I mean, they don't want to hear about, you know, getting money for a laptop. Let's be realistic. I mean, let's be realistic about that, about this. The second quote, and it's gonna be two parts of this. One, I'm gonna read Warren Moon's quote. a lot of criticism he's been, a lot of the criticism he's been receiving is unfortunate and racially based. I thought we were all past this. I don't see other quarterbacks in the draft being criticized by the media or fans about their smile or called a phony. That is in response to this quote from a Pro Football Talk scout, Pro Football Weekly, Nolan Nowacki, who writes scouting reports or writes reports on players coming out the draft. Here's what Nowacki said about Cam Newton. Very disingenuous, has a fake smile, comes off as a very scripted and selfish me first makeup. So right there, you call him phony. Always knows where the cameras are and plays to them. Has an enormous ego with a sense of entitlement that continually invites trouble and makes him believe he is above the law. Does not command respect and teammates, and always will struggle to win a locker room. So you call him selfish and basically a narcissist, and his teammates hate him. Keep in mind that you're talking about a guy in Cam Newton. Number one, has never gotten in trouble off the field as far as breaking any laws. So it's not like he's, you know, he hasn't had any DUIs. He doesn't have no, you know, breaking any injuries, no robberies, nothing like that. His father did the pay-for-play type thing and asked universities for money in order for him to come to their school. That's his father. He didn't do that. That was his father. Let's keep that in mind before we go rip Cam Newton. That's a reflection on his father's character, not his character. Okay. The last two seasons that he's left the field in the last game, he's walked off as a champion. This season as a national champion with Auburn, who nobody in their right minds were picking before the season started. And the season before with Blaine Junior College for their championship. So you're taking a shot at this guy's character and his leadership and his, you know, his me first, I versus team, and he's won two championships in the last 2 years. Explain to me the logic. Again, if you want to take shots at his mechanics, fine. If you want to say that he's, you know, that he's only produced 1 year and you have question marks about that, which he did say, that's fine. I have question marks about that as far as him only producing for 1 year. Those are fair and legitimate questions. But to rip this guy's character is, you know, it's insane. And it does screen racism. And I'm not one who jumps at playing the race card. I just don't do it. But I cannot knock Warren Moon for what he said, because Warren Moon knows he's seen this movie before. Matter of fact, he was the star of this movie back in the day, where he was ripped or stereotyped because as a black quarterback. It cost Warren Moon probably millions of dollars in years of his NFL career. Well, he should have been in the NFL instead of playing over in the, I believe, the Canadian Football League, because of that stereotype of the black quarterback. He knows what it is like. Doug Williams knows what it's like. Charlie Ward knows what it's like. So I can understand the frustration by Warren Moon. He has absolutely the right to say what he said. And again, am I calling this Nolan Nowacki a racist? No, but those comments he made are subliminal racist comments. They are. When did we start gauging guys' smiles in terms of discussing their talent or their skill set? Now we're looking at how a guy smiles. And again, we didn't hear this stuff about Colt McCoy. We didn't hear this stuff about Sam Bradford. We damn sure didn't hear this stuff about Tim Tebow. Yeah, you heard Tim Tebow. You had questions about his mechanics and about his style of play in terms of run first, pass second. But as far as his character goes, he was, you would want him to marry your daughter. Again, to rip Cam Newton's character, to me, is no reason for it. None whatsoever. You want to rip his father? Fine. Rip his character is not fair. So, you know, we'll see where he's drafted at. He's going to be a top 10 pick, maybe even a top 5 pick. Again, I have my doubts about him as a player. I don't have my doubts about him as a man or as a human being, because to go through what he went through over the course of his season, through all the controversy and lead his team to a national championship, let me let you on a little secret, Nolan. That takes character. How many guys would have folded under that pressure? When you go to Alabama, you're down basically 27-0 defending national championship on their home field, and you come back to win 28-27. That's character. All right? You come out of nowhere to lead a team to a national championship. That's character. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. What is wrong with the Spurs? Somebody take out the Bengay. We'll talk about the Spurs NBA Roundup, and we'll introduce a new segment to the program. Stay tuned for that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Minutes after the 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, taking you to 12:30 this afternoon, this special 90-minute edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, Final Four weekend with VCU and Butler and Connecticut, UConn and Kentucky going at it tonight as we near the end of another college basketball season, but certainly we have some great memories that are still to come. Between these three games, between these this weekend and of course Monday night, I believe that the ending of this Monday you're gonna see something that we haven't seen. It has a special feel to it. I like Connecticut to win the whole thing, but I don't know. It has one of these special feels to it to where, you know, it could be VCU or it could be. It could be a Butler. 347-215-6180 is your call number. Mark Melusis will be coming up at around 12 o'clock, a little bit after. So stay tuned for that. Talk some baseball and some little bit of college basketball. A couple things here. The NBA race is really tightening up as far as the race, not in the Western Conference, but the race for the best record in general. San Antonio Spurs now have lost 6 straight. They only had a streak in Lakers who won 9 straight by a game and a half, won in a lost column. But not only do they have the Lakers on their heels for best record, the Bulls are only a game and a half behind, same record as the Lakers. Miami and Boston were 4 games in a lost column. They're not catching. But, you know, yeah, basically Chicago, L.A., and San Antonio all in the race for best record. And, again, San Antonio has to have home court advantage if they have any chance to get to the NBA Finals. I don't think they get to the Finals regardless. I think the Lakers would beat them anywhere. But, you know, if they don't get home court advantage, they won't get to the Lakers. Because I believe that if they finish, you know, second or third, that they could lose to Dallas in the first round, in the second round, and possibly maybe get taken out by, say, a Portland in the second round. Keep your eyes in the Western Conference on that 6, 7, 8 spot. Portland, New Orleans, and Memphis are battling for those spots. I think all three of those teams, I know Houston's playing well, but I think all three of those teams probably are going to make the playoffs. Portland is the team that nobody, including the Lakers, really want to see in the Western Conference first round. Portland has the matchup. They can match up with anybody. The only thing they really lack is playoff experience for the most part because they haven't played in that many big-time playoff games. But they're a team that you do not want to see with their length, the Gerald Wallace, their defense. Nate McMillan is a great coach. Nobody wants to see that team, in particular Dallas. Dallas does not want to see that team. As it stands right now, the Lakers would play New Orleans, which I'm sure they would love. They own New Orleans. Portland would play Dallas. Dallas wants no part of Portland. You saw what the Mavericks are made of on Thursday night. They are still a soft jump shooting team that has no chance against the Lakers in the playoff series. That's all there is to it. They're still soft. That perception exists, and it's very much true that they are a soft team. My team of the week goes to the Cleveland Cavaliers. They take out the Miami Heat by 12 points, and the thing I loved about this game is the fact that Miami actually was trying to win, but it did not make a difference. It was just Cleveland's night, played with a ton of energy, made big three-pointers, and got the win. So good for the Cleveland Cavaliers fans. They deserved it, considering how what kind of season it's been, and considering that they, you know, had the worst record in basketball. But you know, who knows? Maybe they get a Derek Williams or somebody of that ilk coming out in this year's draft. So there you go with the NBA. Want to introduce a new segment real quick to the program that we're going to be doing during our shows. It's called
Are You Kidding Me?
Yes, Are You Kidding Me? Where each week I'll, look at a couple stories that just blow my mind and just I can't believe that I'm reading them. Story number one, Aqib Talib, the cornerback from Tampa Bay, arrested on firing a gun at his sister's boyfriend. And again, he fired the gun at his sister's boyfriend. He's out now on $25,000 bond. Okay, he's out on $25,000 bond, but he has some help with him. His mother, Akolo Talib, also shot at the sister's boyfriend back on March 21st. Again, both of them are out on bond as it stands. And again, Talib, who's had some issues in the past, I would have to think that they will, that Tampa Bay has to cut ties with him. It's just a pure example to me of why the NFL lockout needs to end. It needs to end right now. Story number two, Dez Bryant owes $850,000 in terms of jury sporting tickets and loans.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. Dez Bryant, okay, originally he owes two separate jury. He owes two separate people. One in Dallas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, a juror that he owes $267,000 to. That he bought $267,000 of jury, but only paid on it $21,000 of in terms of credit. Why would you? Why you would pay $21,000 for $267,000 for a jury when you're a millionaire is beyond me. Let's put that aside for a minute. In New York, he owes a New York juror and ticket broker, Elo Hunt, $588,000 in terms of jury tickets and loans. The tickets are tickets that he purchased before he got drafted to Minnesota Vikings playoff games and Dallas Maverick playoff games and Dallas Cowboys playoff games, and also bought $11,000 on that. He has not paid any of that back. He hasn't paid any of that back. So out of the $850,000 that he owes between these two, between the juror in Dallas and the juror and ticket broker in New York, he's only paid $21,000 on. Dez Bryant, here's some of the things that he brought, that he bought. $65,000, $500 diamond cross, $60,000 custom charm, white gold diamonds, $35,000 worth of cash, $54,000 in terms of a meal that he played. I remember that might have been the prank that was played on him by Roy Williams with the whole tab. $54,000 on a meal, on food. Okay, his contract was an $8.3 million signing bonus that he signed in his rookie season in 2010. Half of that, of course, will go to Uncle Sam. So he's basically spent $850,000 of his money on basically jewelry. We just finished talking about stereotypes of black athletes. I can defend the Cam Newton one with the black quarterback thing. I'll defend that too, so I'll put some blue in the face. This one, I will not defend on black athletes just not knowing how to manage their money. I'm not going to say all, but there are too many of these guys, especially in the NFL, especially 25 and under, who get this quick money and just go crazy. They don't know what to do with it. I'm like, dude, do you know that we're in a lockout right now? Do you know that you know, the next time you do play football that, you know, one play in your career could be over? You recognize that? Carson Palmer recently came out and said, I have $80 million in the bank. Okay, Carson Palmer has made $55 million worth of signed for $55 million worth of signing bonuses in his two contracts. His first one, his rookie contract. The second one, his $118 million 6-year contract extension. But he has $80 million in the bank. That's called investing. That's called not going out there and buying every piece of jewelry or platinum rims. It's called using your noodle. And the crazy thing about this, it would be the guys who spend the most money. Again, and I have to stop here because we have our buddy Malusis on the phone. Let's get him on the air here. The Moose, how you doing, man?
What's going on, Cyril? How are you, man?
I'm doing fine. You just caught me in the middle of a rant that I was going over with our buddy Dez Bryant.
Oh, I got it. Well, Dez will give you a lot to talk about, no?
Oh, my goodness. Hey, Mark, $850,000 of jewelry?
Yeah, that's a little much for a rookie, no? I mean, and that was an issue. You know, he had issues at Oklahoma State. I mean, there's no denying the talent that he has. You know, but he had issues as far as waking up for practice and taking care of his responsibilities, and he's a little bit of a head case. That's why he dropped down in the draft the way he did, and the Cowboys were able to get him at that point in the first round. But, you know, there's no denying the talent. Unfortunately, if he can't handle it, you know, and be able to conduct himself as a professional, you know, that talent's going to go by the wayside. There's it's only going to be so long to where an NFL team's going to tell him, you know what, enough's enough. I mean, I'm not saying the Cowboys are at that point, but Dez Bryant's got to grow up a little bit. I understand he's only 21, 22 years of age. He's still a young man, but he's got to realize that, you know, he represents an organization. He's an NFL player. That he's no longer in college. He's no longer 15 years old. That he's got to conduct himself in the proper fashion.
This is Mark Malusis joining us. Of course, Mark, you can hear Mark on WFAN on doing some overnight work and also on SNY. With doing some Mets stuff. Let's, you know, we're going to get to the baseball here, Mark. I'll deal with the Mets first. Unfortunately, to get them out the way. But
right.
I recently read an article about this proposed sale that the Mets in the New York Times. The Mets want to sell. They're looking to be sold for $200 million for a minority portion of it. It seems to me that there's some people that are interested in it. Can this thing work out if the Mets aren't sold as a whole? I mean, are the Wilpons, you know, if you're a Mets fan, wouldn't you just want them to be completely sold 100%?
You know, I can't say that. I mean, I think, you know, people knock around Fred and Jeff and, you know, the team hasn't won and they've been a disappointment. And I'm not saying that – there aren't issues with the Mets ownership. There certainly are, but, you know, it's not their fault. I mean, they've spent a lot of money. Unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that they, you know, entrusted Omar Minaya. He made, you know, some bad personnel moves that didn't work out, like a Luis Castillo, like an Oliver Perez, and, you know, go up and down the line. And, you know, now you look at it, I think obviously the Madoff situation has changed things drastically. You know, they're being sued by Irving Picard, who's looking to get money back from them. But I think if they sell a minority ownership, I don't think Fred and Jeff have any interest in selling, you know, full ownership or majority ownership of the team. And, you know, they're going to be here. They, you know, and I think they've got a good management now running the organization in Alderson and Deep Podesta and J.P. Ricciardi. I think they're going to spend money wisely. You know, you got to look at it, Cyril. I mean, it's not like the Mets were spending $75 million a year on payroll. I mean, they were the highest payroll in the National League for quite some time at 143. And you look at it this year, they got a team on the field, and they have, in essence, you want to add in Johan Santana, you know, empty money, $12 million to Oliver Perez. He's gone. $6 million to Castillo. They're still paying Gary Matthews Jr. $1 million. That's 19. And then you consider Johan Santana, and he's due $23.5 million. That's another $11.5 million. So they basically, to start the year, about 30, it count half of Santana's money, about $30.5 million of just empty money going to no production on the field. I mean, that is a monumental hit.
Oh, absolutely. That's like that's the Kansas City Royals payroll.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think you're right. I mean, the Royals payroll, I think, is like $32 million or something like that. I mean, that's a lot of empty money. And, you know, certainly they have financial issues. But I don't know, if I'm a Met fan, I'm saying, you know what, I can't wait for Fred and Jeff to sell the team fully. I mean, I really can't say that.
Let's say, for argument's sake, and that's very fair what you said, that let's put all the Madoff stuff aside, because I heard Mike the other day, and he said nobody knows basically what's going on, and I couldn't agree with you more. If you look at all the facts and everything in it, we don't know what is going to become of this situation, who did what, and who it just has to be worked out. Hopefully, it's worked out as soon as possible so the franchise can move on. But
right.
looking on the field product, what sense did you get of the Mets? Mentality coming out of spring training, what were some of the things that they were saying, sifting through what all teams say, that we like our teams, so getting through, putting that aside, what did you get a sense of how the Mets felt going into this season?
Yeah, I think as a team, I think they feel pretty good. You know, I think, you know, they understand the importance of getting off to a good start. I think Terry Collins, the manager, sent out a letter yesterday, understands that very fact, that they have to get off to a good start. But I think they've gotten rid of a headache in Perez, and they've gotten rid of a headache in Luis Castillo, who since has been cut by the Philadelphia Phillies. I think they're, you know, a more workmanlike play, the game the right way. The reports that I got down, you know, in Port St. Lucie was that, you know, the coaches were running, you know, drills, that they were on top of them. It was a very intense, you know, they were doing a lot of work, getting back to playing baseball the right way. You know, I know David Wright is comparing this team to the 06 team and being a contender. I don't see that, but I don't think the Mets are going to be a comedy of errors on the field. I don't think they're going to go out there and beat themselves. I think they're going to play smart baseball. Like, I really do, and I like the Collins mentality. I'm sure over the course of time it can wear thin, his intensity. But everything you get from the Mets is that, you know what, it's a good change. It's a refreshing change. They went from a couple players, managers, Emmanuel, Willie Randolph, to now a manager that's a disciplinarian, and I think that's good. I mean, you see that in the National Football League a lot, where you go from a player's coach to a disciplinarian, or a disciplinarian to a player's coach, and I think the change will suit the Mets good. I think they'll play well this year. I don't think they're going to contend, but I think there'll be some bright spots this year, some things to root for as far as the Mets are concerned.
Let me give you two injuries, and you tell me which one should I be more concerned about, Beltran or Jason Bay?
I would say Bay, because of the year Bay's coming off of. Because you have two more years, you know, you're invested in Jason Bay, after this season comes to an end. You know, this is going to be it for Beltran. And I think if you're a realistic Met fan, whatever you get from Beltran this year, Cyril, I think is an absolute positive. I think they're going to try and piece the season together. You know, he's got an arthritic condition. That's not going away anytime. It's only going to get worse. He doesn't have good knees. One of them is particularly worse than the other. He's going to have to play through pain. But you don't have an investment in Beltran past this year. You do in Bay. And the lack of pop in spring, the lack of pop last year. There's concern, you know, you have a right to be concerned about Bay. You want Bay to have a good year this year, to be that player that he was up in Boston and before that with the Pittsburgh Pirates.
I think, you know, I'm looking at the Mets rotation. And to me, again, Santana, when he gets back, he gets back. Pelfrey, I think, will be decent. But to me, I'm looking at the guy who I got circled, is who could be the wild card possibly, is Chris Young. How has he performed? What are the expectations out of him, out of the Mets, from him coming into this season?
Yeah, I think they like Young. I think the Mets feel as an organization that they got a guy that was kind of forgotten about. I mean, you know, the question with him is not about his ability to pitch or his ability to get guys out. I mean, when he's healthy, Cyril, he's a good pitcher. I mean, he's shown that. Former All-Star with the San Diego Padres. The problem is his arm going to be able to hold up? The problem is that can he stay healthy? I mean, I think the Mets like what they saw. I mean, you look at it, he's probably the Mets' best starting pitcher in the spring. Pelfrey got knocked around last night, pitched poorly. Nice was okay. Dickey was okay. But I think Chris Young was very good start in, start out over the course of the spring. And I think the Mets really liked what they saw. Now the question is, can he hold up for the entire year?
How many wins before we get to the Yankees?
For Young? I think they're going to finish over 500. I'm going to say they're going to win 82 to 84 games, something of that nature.
Wow. That would be a great season, to be honest with you.
I mean, you know, take that better than the SI prediction of 74, right? And finishing dead last against the Nets.
Yeah. I did a prediction show as far as I did a segment on that as far as the NL East and what I thought. It hurt me as a Mets fan, but I did predict a massive finish ahead of them. It's not even so much with the on the field stuff, but just everything that's going on with this team. It seems like they're almost cursed. It's remarkable from how we're going from Game 7, 2006 NLCS to where they are at right now. It really is.
Oh, it is. You're right about that. It's been, a comedy of errors, a lot of drama, more off the field than on the field, poor performance on the field. You're right. I mean, 2006, you know, sitting in there at Shea Stadium in that playoff series with my dad, it seems like a long time ago against the Cardinals. I mean, that seems like forever ago, but here we are. And hopefully the Mets are able to get back relevant, like you mentioned before, get this Madoff situation behind them at some point in the not-so-distant future, you know, get back to where the product on the field is the story and not all the drama, because the drama has been the story for way too long for the Mets.
All right, let's get on to the big team here, the Yankees. I'm looking at this team, Mark, and I think they're playoff caliber, but I definitely, when looking at their roster, I really took a good close look at it over the course of this week. There's a lot of age with that team. How concerned are you about that? About all those like 16 guys over the age of 30?
Yeah, it's concerning. In certain spots, I mean, you're concerned about Mariano, even though Soriano was a very good closer last year for the Rays. There's only one Mariano Rivera, and he's 41,
right,
42 years of age. So. And he has been so dominant for so long, you know, at some point in time, you know, Father Time is going to catch up with him. You know, hopefully it's not this year. I mean, the Yankees are old. I mean, they are what they are in certain spots. I mean, you look at it, you know, Posada will be gone after this year. You know, you know they got Young and left with Gardner. Granderson's young. Swisher's relatively young. You know, Cano's entering this prime. I mean, you look at that left side of the infield, that is really where the focus is as far as the age goes, where you have a 36, 37-year-old shortstop and you have a 35-year-old third baseman. But, you know, the age is really, to me, it just comes with the territory. You know, the Yankees pay for established players. You know, you can never predict injuries. You can never predict the, you know, the effect of father time on a player. If it comes back and haunts them this year, I do know this. I know Cashman and that front office will be awfully aggressive to try and make some trades and to try and get this team back to October. The biggest concern for me still remains the starting rotation.
Oh, absolutely. I would just that's a perfect segue. They're going. You and I both know that this team is going to score runs with anybody, regardless of what the age and what have you. They have enough. They have offense. They have enough offense to kind of hold. To keep the ship abroad, but the starting pitching, everybody talks about the 4 and 5 starters, but really, realistically, there is one guy on that starting pitching staff that I trust completely, and we all know who that guy is. Hughes, good in the regular season, terrible in the postseason. Burnett is, Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. We know about him. How concerned are they about this pitching staff as a whole? Not just the 4 and 5 stars, but just as a whole, the starting pitching staff.
Yeah, I agree with you about Sabathia. You know, I would imagine they're not so much concerned about Hughes. And, you know, Burnett is what he is. I mean, I don't think, when a guy shows himself to be as inconsistent as Burnett has been, you talk about a guy that's won 18 games once in his career. And ironically enough, that was his walk year with the Toronto Blue Jays, where he opted out of his contract and signed that $82.5 million deal with the Yankees. So, I mean, that was the only year that he's ever won 18 games, and he's got tantalizing stuff. But I really think the Yankees more so look at this starting rotation and where the lineup and the age factors in. They believe and I think it too, the lineup's going to be able to make up for some of the ills of the staff in the regular season. The problem is this staff, unless Burnett takes a monumental step forward, this staff, as presently constituted, probably not good enough to win a World Series come October and win baseball playoff games come October and be dominant come October. And I think that's what the Yankees are most concerned about. I think Hughes will be good. I think Burnett will be up and down. I think Sabathia will be solid. I think, you expect up and downs with Ivan Nova. And number 5 spot in that starting rotation is kind of going to be a merry-go-round as far as riding the hot hand.
I saw some. I'm surprised on how many. And, again, I understand that the hatred between the two teams with the Red Sox and Yankees, but you have to be somewhat objective. The New York Daily News did their predictions, and I'm sure you saw this, seen this. They had the Red Sox third place with 88-74, one game less than what they were last season without the acquisitions and without, with the injuries that they had. Are you surprised by that? Have you seen that?
Yeah, to me that makes absolutely no sense. I mean, honestly, I know you have to, you have to pull for New York, and I think, we all would like to see the Yankees and the Mets do well and everything like that, but in all reality, you look at the Red Sox. The Red Sox have a better starting rotation, 1-5, right? They're coming off a year. They improved their lineup in Crawford and Gonzalez. There's no question about that. If Ellsbury is able to stay healthy, you know what Ellsbury can be. The only edge the Yankees really have over Boston would be that back end of the bullpen. I mean, that would really be it right now. Aside from that, I mean, the Red Sox are a better baseball team. And the fact that they have them finishing third in the American League East, to me, makes absolutely no sense.
So you agree that the Red Sox should be favored to win that division. Not saying that it's going to automatically happen, but they deserve to be favored to win.
Are going to win the division. I agree with you, Cyril. I think they are the deserved favorite. I mean, if I were in Vegas and before the start of the year and I were to make a bet as far as who are going to win the American League East, I'd say the Boston Red Sox. I would, because I think Gonzalez is going to have a huge year in that new ballpark. Yeah, I think he could win the MVP. I mean, honestly, you look at what he was able to do in basically Yellowstone National Park out in San Diego and the amount of offensive production. Now you put him up in that bandbox up at Fenway Park, I think he's going to have a huge offensive year.
With that being said, in terms of you know, the Red Sox Yankee thing is something I didn't get to you last time. I wanted to ask you about Cashman's comments and about the Red Sox and basically admitting, saying, hey, they are better and so on and so on. And, you know, the first thing I thought about when he made those comments was the late George Steinbrenner. Do those comments get made if George Steinbrenner, not only one, is alive, but number two, if he was still running the Yankees?
If it was the old George, probably not. I mean, you know, if we're talking about the later on in life George Steinbrenner.
Yeah, I'm talking about the George that was running the team.
Yeah, the old school George Steinbrenner, yeah. I mean, I'd probably say probably no. I mean, you know, but who knows? If it was the old George Steinbrenner, Cashman probably would have been fired by now. So, I mean, but I would probably agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, when that was the case, it was George's word and nobody else's. So things have certainly changed. And I probably agree with you that Cashman probably wouldn't be making those statements.
Couple of more, and I'll move on to the final four real quick. Derek Jeter finish? Does Derek Jeter finish the year at shortstop?
I think he does. Yeah, I think he does. You know, I love Jeter. You know, and I'm a Jeter fan, and I think those that are calling for his demise or whatever, I think it's a little bit too early, a little bit too premature. I think he's shown you throughout his career to be able to make adjustments when he gets older. You know, did defensively at shortstop last couple of years. I know he's coming off a year in which he had 270 last year or so, but I think he's gonna have a pretty good offensive year. I don't think he's gonna hit 320 or 330. But I think Jeter will finish at shortstop. I think he'll play a pretty good defensive shortstop, and I think he'll be a good bat at the top of that lineup, whether he hits one or two.
And give me a win total for the Yankees.
I have the Yankees probably about 94, 95 wins. I have the Red Sox about 98. So I think Boston wins the division. I think the Yankees are going to be the wild card in the American League.
Yeah, I can see it. I definitely can see it. It's going to be very interesting between that whole dynamic with the Red Sox, Yankees, and the AL Central. So that,
yeah,
I
wouldn't. Yeah, you look at it. I mean, I think Toronto's improved in the American League East. You know, I like what Buck is doing down in Baltimore. I'm a Buck fan, but you know what he's great at? He's great with these young teams. You know, he'll drive veterans crazy with all of his rules, but he's great with these young teams. And I think Buck is good that he's back in baseball managing a team.
Oh, absolutely. I love the mentality that he's brought to that to Baltimore already. So, you know, we'll see about that. How about this final four here, Mark? Obviously, New York interest with UConn is always a big thing. Give me just an overall assessment of what you think and who you think is going to cut down the next Monday.
You know, I'll take a little chalk, sir. I like Kentucky. You know, I like how they got through the East, going through Ohio State and Carolina. You know, I think it's kind of ironic because last year everybody was on Kentucky, and rightfully so, with those five first-round draft choices that went to the NBA, led by John Wall and Cousins and, you know, Bledsoe, who got drafted by the Clippers. I think it's going to be Kentucky. I think UConn's magical run comes to an end tonight. I think it's going to be Kentucky and Butler Monday night, and I think the Wildcats are going to win. But, you know, would I be surprised if it went another way? No. I mean, I think this tournament has shown you that anybody has a chance. They've been great games. It's been a phenomenal tournament. And I think you're going to get two great games tonight. And I think you're going to get a great national championship game.
Yeah, I mean, for the first time in a long time, really anyone of these teams can win the championship. I wouldn't be shocked if anyone is VCU. If VCU is cut down the next Monday night, you can't be shocked. So
no.
I completely agree. I agree with you there. I like UConn myself. I think
you do.
Yeah, I mean, I think they had the best player, and I think they had the best coach left in the field. So I'm using that as a barometer, I feel, in terms of, I don't love them. I like them.
Let me ask you this question. How are they going to make an adjustment if Calipari, and Kentucky's a good defensive team, they're going to make an adjustment. They met earlier in the regular season in the Maui. They're going to put Leggins, who's 6'5", on Kemba Walker, who's probably about 5'11 and a half, 6 feet tall. You know, if Leggins is able to do a good job defensively, you know, besides Lamb, where is UConn going for their points?
I see. That's where we differ, because I don't think anybody in this tournament remaining, even the NORAD kid on Butler, I don't think anybody can guard Walker.
That's
I really don't. I think he's I really can understand what you're saying, because that, you know, length, we've seen guys with length bother other quicker guys. You know, we saw Corey Brewer in the Final Four, but, you know, just take out Farmore and Fowler and Darren Collison. And,
yeah, great example. Very good example.
So we saw that, but this dude, I mean, Calipari even said it himself about the whole Danny Manning and that comparison. This guy right now, he's playing on such a level. I just don't see anybody stopping him. He had an off game to me against Arizona and had 20 points and 7 assists. And I didn't think he played well. So that's the level that he's playing at right now.
No, that's a fair point. That's a good point. You're right. I mean, listen, the one thing that Walker can do that can get away from the length is, I mean, off the dribble. I mean, he's as quick as anything. The ball is basically on a string. I mean, he is as good as off the dribble as far as being able to get space and get his own shot that I've seen in quite some time on the college level.
And I also think that, you know, again, both of them close games either way, flip of a coin. But I also think that the Kentucky, I'm looking at I'm a North Carolina fan, and I'm thinking to myself, if Kentucky shoots 10 for 22 instead of 12 for 22 for 3-point range, they lose that game. I mean, that's how close that game was. Can they come up with another, you know, crazy 3-point shooting game like that? It's possible, but, you know, live by a three, die by a three. So it'll be very interesting from both their perspective and BCU's, who've been just, I mean, shooting ridiculous from 3-point range, 40%.
BCU, I think I saw a stat. What are they shooting? About 55% of the team from behind the arc. I mean, they've been ridiculous shooting the ball from the outside.
It's ridiculous. It's crazy. The game has changed so much to where North Carolina has an NBA front court. They have an NBA front court. But you know what? If you don't have a shooter, at least one or two shooters, it doesn't matter because, I mean, that 3-point shot it negates everything. It really makes up for a lack of talent. So you've got to have at least one or two of those. And that's what this tournament has shown.
It's the great equalizer. And no other game. I mean, you look at that. Think about this, how important a 3-point shot is on the college level. You go back to a game earlier on in the tournament, BYU against Florida. Those teams in that game combined to shoot 71 threes. And that was BYU's mantra going into that game. The three is the great equalizer. They realized they couldn't match up with Florida's, you know, physical talent. They realized that without Davies, their front court was going to struggle a little bit. And you got Fredette, obviously, who's going to shoot the Dickens out of the basketball. But those two teams in a game, in a 40-minute collegiate game, shot 71 three-pointers. I mean, that just tells you about the importance of the three, more so than anything else at on the college level.
Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. Again, appreciate you for coming on, and certainly over the course of this baseball season, which is a marathon, as we know, we'll certainly have you on if anything big happens, or just keep us up to date on the Mets and Yankees. Thanks for coming on, Mark.
Absolutely, Cyril. Anytime, man. Whenever you need me, just let me know, all right?
All right. Take it easy.
You got it, man. Be well.
That was, of course, Mark Melusis, who always did a wonderful job, always does a wonderful job in terms of giving us the 411 on New York baseball and sports in general. Melusis is great. He's been knowing for a long time, going back to when he was a producer for Mike and the Mad Dog. Does a wonderful job, does a wonderful job with that spot. Listen, in regards to the Final Four, again, I like UConn and Butler, and I'll take the Butler experience, and you know their seniors with Shelvin Mack and Matt Howard, VCU maybe just happy to be there subconsciously. When you talk about UConn and Kentucky, I'll take the UConn the best coach, best player. Kemba Walker will be, without question, the best player on the floor out of all the four teams, but definitely on the floor against Kentucky. I don't think there's anybody in this tournament that's remaining that can guard that kid. Anybody. He's been that good. Like I said, he had an off game. Okay, he had an off game against Arizona. Jeremy Lamb has become a star. Lamb has played great, averaging about 18 a game in the tournament, become showing you that he's going to be the next great player in UConn's tradition, along with the likes of like a Ray Allen, Rip Hamilton, in that mode. But you know, I mean, that guy has been just ridiculously good. I mean, you can't guard him. You cannot. He can step back, hit the step back, so he can have 3-point range. He gets to the hole. He finishes strong. He's fearless. He breaks down your defense, and he makes good decisions. He is not, for a guy who likes to shoot the ball, he is not a selfish player by any stretch of the imagination. He gets his teammates involved. He gets his teammates involved. Again, has 7 assists, averaging about at least 6 assists a game over the course of the season. So this guy, again, is a big, to me, is the MVP of college basketball, as far as I'm concerned, for what he does for that team, considering how young they were. UConn, Lamb is a freshman. They have 3 freshmen that play key roles in what they do. Oriaki, the big man, is a sophomore. Very young team that UConn has. And you wonder, I forgot to ask Mark this, if Calhoun wins a championship, you wonder if he won't just call it a career. 3 championships. He's won a million games. Has had some health problems. You wonder if this would not be the last Final Four for Jim Calhoun if he cuts down the nets on Monday night. A couple of shout-outs before we head on out. Again, shout-out to Mark Malusis for doing a tremendous job, taking time out of his schedule to come on to the program. Shout-out to my girl Dee Perez, who one of the funniest women on radio right now. Forget about Blog Talk Radio, radio in general. She will have you in stitches. Listen to her program Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the Real Radio, Real Radio, Deep with Deep Perez. Funny show, funny girl. So shout out to her. Definitely shout out to her. Shout out to all my kids, and I'm not talking about any higher than any kids, all the kids at my school will be getting prepared for their upcoming test next week for DC Cast. They are more than well prepared, and they're certainly going to do a wonderful job, so definitely a shout-out to them as well. And a shout-out to you, the audience, for listening to the program, giving me feedback, tell me what you think as far as the segments. Are you kidding me? We're starting. We got the baseball segment starting. So, I'd like to hear your feedback. I'd like to hear your opinions as always. Again, the poll question of the morning is, who do you like to play for the national championship on Monday night? UConn-Butler, will it be UConn-VCU, will it be Kentucky-Butler, or will it be Kentucky and VCU? I like Butler and UConn, but again, trying to predict this tournament is like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Haystack has just been one of the most unpredictable tournaments maybe of all time. Certainly, nobody knows what's going to happen. Anybody tells you they know what's going to happen doesn't have a clue. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't listen to them. So we'll see what transpires tonight around 11:30. We'll find out who will be playing for a national championship. We'll be on the air Monday at 8:00. I will take you to the tip from 8 to 9 on the Cyril Quinn Review to talk about the upcoming national championship game, and also talk about the weekend's action in baseball and look back at, of course, the Final Four. So we'll talk about that and much, much more on the Cyril Quinn Review coming up on Monday night. I will see you then. Enjoy the games. Enjoy the baseball. Enjoy your weekend. So long.